From The Conversation, this is Politics with Michelle Grattan, a podcast where we hear from politicians and experts on the issues of the day.
The government is ramping up national security ahead of the election. Last week, Scott Morrison and his ministers were accusing Labor of being weak on China, even though most commentators agree there's basically a bipartisan policy towards that country and its increasing aggression. The crisis over Ukraine is also feeding into the Morrison government's push for national security to be front and centre. Brendan O'Connor is Labor's defence spokesman, and in the last Labor government, among other portfolios, he was Minister for Home Affairs and Minister for Immigration, and he also served on the Cabinet's National Security Committee. He joins us today to talk about China, Ukraine and defence issues. Brendan O'Connor, the government is determined to make national security an issue at the coming election. Do you think it is an issue, or do you reject that?
Well, national security is the greatest priority of any federal government in order to protect the interests of the country and its citizens. But we should not be politicising national security for base political purposes, and that's been on display now for certainly the last couple of weeks, and the government really needs to start to desist from that behaviour, because that only assists other sovereign states who may want to interfere with this country. So it is a critical issue. It will always be a critical issue, but it shouldn't be debased in the manner in which Scott Morrison has chosen to do so recently.
And it shouldn't be a partisan issue at the election, you're saying?
No, because there are no significant issues of difference between the two major parties. And to suggest otherwise, as former heads of national security agencies have recently said, only provides succour and support to those countries who want to cause mischief. As the former head of many agencies, including Defence and DFAT, and our ambassador in Washington said, Dennis Richardson, that it was only serving the interests of China, not Australia, to make such a claim.
Now, we've been reminded in the last few days of how provocative China is these days with the laser attack on an Australian aircraft. Crossbencher Rex Patrick has said that Australia should expel the Chinese defence attaché in response to this. Do you agree? Or if you don't, what should we be doing in response?
Okay. Look, I haven't seen those comments by Senator Patrick, but we've called for a briefing of the details of this very serious and disturbing incident. We'd like to know exactly the details of what happened, where it happened, how it happened. And yes, we'd also want to know from national security agencies what they believe we should be considering. And that includes, obviously, DFAT and the Department of Defence and the ADF and others. It seems fitting that Labor waits for that briefing. I wrote to the Defence Minister yesterday asking for a briefing for the Shadow Minister for Foreign Affairs and I to be briefed.
And no response yet?
No, I'm expecting a response today at the latest. I haven't had any difficulties getting briefings before. We want the ADF and the department to be there. We need to understand the detail. I mean, we're on the eve of an election. It's absolutely critical that the federal opposition is provided with these matters and the information in relation to this matter so that we are aware of the circumstances and can consider our position accordingly.
Also on China, Labor says that there's a bipartisan policy, but is this glossing over differences of detail? Would the tone be different under Labor?
Well, we've made clear that we need to use temperate language in order to maintain peace and stability in the region. That's not for a moment to suggest we do not call out acts of aggression or coercion, but it is intended that we maintain stability, and we convey and we make sure that we're very mindful of the language we use. We don't think the drumbeats of war type of rhetoric is useful, and in fact, if anything, will defeat the purpose of maintaining peace and predictability. So, yes, I think it's fair to say we wouldn't, for example, answer a hypothetical question about going to war with a nuclear superpower in the affirmative, the way in which the defence minister did. We don't think that's helpful. We think it's actually counterintuitive. It doesn't serve the purpose of this nation, and it shouldn't happen.
Looking to the future, how do you see China evolving in the medium term? Do you think its aggression will increase? And, for example, do you think that it will move on Taiwan in the next 5 years?
The advice we've received is that certainly China is acting in a very different way than it did a decade ago or even 5 years ago. We are concerned that it could continue in this manner, acting out its own ambitions in a way that's contrary to international law. We have to therefore accept that there's a significant likelihood that that behaviour will continue. And that's why it's absolutely incumbent upon Australia to work with our partners in the region through ASEAN and other regional bodies, work with our partners in AUKUS and the Quad to deter or seek to deter such conduct. I mean, our strong position has to be, along with our allies and friends, that international law needs to be complied with by all sovereign states, and that includes China. And therefore, our focus must be on seeking to ensure that.
So, do you think that Australia and its allies and regional partners would have to react to a move on Taiwan in a military way?
Well, I think we need to, and this is what I made the point earlier about answering hypothetical questions. Clearly, we are concerned about the relationship between China and mainland China and Taiwan. We've made it very clear that we do not want to see China act aggressively towards Taiwan. We've made clear also that we want to maintain and we want to seek to maintain stability in the region. And therefore, any incursion by China into Taiwan will actually create instability and, of course, cause significant alarm across the region and globally. So our message has to be very clear. And I think we've made it very clear through the Quad, through through regional bodies, that China should maintain good relations with countries within the region and maintain its current relationship with Taiwan insofar as recognising its right of order, of autonomous government.
Now, turning to Ukraine, which has come to boiling point, President Putin has just said that Russia recognises the independence of two separatist regions. This has been denounced by Western countries. The Europeans have foreshadowed sanctions. What should Australia do? There's been talk, for example, of even sending arms, not troops, but arms to Ukraine. Would Labor support that?
Well, we'd like to be brief, but can I just respond to the decision by President Putin to act in this way? It is a blatant, fundamental breach of international law to make such a decision, and it's for that reason there's been an outcry collectively across the world for this decision. And our position, therefore, has to be that we engage with our friends, particularly out the NATO states and the United States, as to what best we can do to reduce the likelihood of any invasion by Russia of the Ukraine. That is the first step that we need to undertake. So engage with our partners, our friends in Europe, the United States, and really, I mean, they are obviously the primary actors in this matter, but we will work consistently with them. What action we do take to complement, to assist those countries who are responding to the decision by President Putin is something that we should be briefed on before we make any decision. Again, opposition, you need to be briefed by your security agencies prior to making precise decisions in response to decisions by other sovereign states.
Labor's supported the AUKUS agreement, but would a Labor government be looking for anything extra out of this agreement?
Look, the one thing that why AUKUS is important, apart from the obvious nuclear-propelled submarines is the access to the technologies of the United States and the United Kingdom that will provide greater defence capability in areas of cybersecurity and artificial intelligence and other emerging areas which are so important to defend this country. So AUKUS is, there's been a lot of conversation around subs, but of course there's so much more under that umbrella that can be of benefit to the country and to our defence force. So that's the first thing. But look, we are mindful of the fact that many of these plans under AUKUS are off to the medium and long term, including the first boat in the water by at best late 2030s, possibly later. And we need to look at whether, in fact, we need to do more prior to the delivery of certain assets arising out of that AUKUS arrangement. We have concerns, for example, about a possible defence capability gap between the current Collins-class submarines and the delivery of the first submarine under AUKUS. We're concerned about whether we've got sufficient capability in cybersecurity. It's an area where the government, I think, faltered and neglected for too long and is now responding belatedly. We will need a full comprehensive brief across the spectrum of defence capability, including the contracts, many of which are under enormous pressure because of their failing to deliver. Just take the frigates. There's been a failure to deliver what was promised, and we will have to examine whether, in fact, that contract is on track and whether it can deliver what it promised. I mean, the great gap, Michelle, in defence is not between what the government will do and what the Labor Party will do. It's what the government says it will do and what it actually does, what it actually delivers. There's a yawning gap between the rhetoric of Peter Dutton and the delivery of assets to the Australian Defence Force.
Well, one of the problems, presumably, one of the causes of that gap is inefficiency in overseeing or driving these contracts. It's probably not just the politics, but really down in the weeds. Is that right? And what can you do about that?
Well, I think you start by not having six defence ministers in 8 years. Scott Morrison, for all of his talk about national security, has had four defence ministers in less than 4 years. That means there's no political continuity to drive the contracts, to make sure we're complying with the commitments that have been made under such huge billion-dollar contracts. This is we've had a revolving door at the ministerial level, which has not served us well. And we've got a current minister for all of his pantomime has been a minister for less than a year, and he's identified problems but he hasn't been able to fix them. But that's been because this government's now seeking another decade in office and really hasn't delivered much except for high intemperate rhetoric about national security, and has sought to divide us as a nation on the most important matter that a national government is responsible for, which is really, quite frankly, obscene and should desist.
You mentioned the gap because these nuclear-powered subs are a long time away. How would you fill that gap? Would you think of leasing submarines, nuclear-powered submarines, or conventional submarines?
Yeah. Look, there's a combination of ways. In the area of submarines, there's a combination of options available, I think, to the country. It may well be... firstly, the government, for example, should have made the decision on extending the life of the Collins-class in 2015, when it was advised to by the Defence Department, and only chose last year to make that announcement. So we're 5-6 years behind on the delivery of the upgrading of conventional vessels, our conventional boats, the submarines. We can be looking at a supplement insofar as another conventional submarine. We can look at possible leasing arrangements, but be very clear, if we're looking to lease nuclear submarines, we have to have the skills, the capability, the understanding of nuclear technology. Given that we don't have a nuclear industry, we have enormous amount of work to build the nuclear infrastructure and skills in this country to actually crew such a submarine. So it's not just a question of leasing the submarine and then we can use it. The United States, for example, would not provide us a submarine without fully being assured that we have the capability, both to crew and to maintain such a complex piece of defence asset.
So is it practical? Do you think a Labor government could lease a nuclear submarine?
I think there's, as I said, there's plenty of reasons why that will take significant time, given what we would need to do beyond just the leasing of that asset. We would need to have, for example, we would have to have submariners with, you know, with the skills to operate that boat. We would need infrastructure where that boat was docked and where it was maintained. So that would take a considerable amount of years. So we'd have to consider how long that might take before we could potentially lease, if indeed the United States or the United Kingdom were willing to lease a boat, given their own.
So better to have a conventional lease, a conventional.
So I'm making the point that I'm not, whilst you would not rule that out, I'm making the point there's considerable challenges to that, you know, to actually implement that option. And yes, there still is, and there is still merit in, you know, looking at conventional submarines if that's where the capability gap lies. But can I say, Michelle, it is very difficult, and it would be wrong for the opposition to be making decisions about the next 5 to 10 years or 15 years to fill a possible gap without being fully briefed. And we'll only be briefed to the detail we require to make some of these decisions from government. So whilst we can make and we have made decisions and we have been briefed and have made and joined the government in making some threshold decisions around AUKUS and certainly some other defence asset decisions, we would need to be comprehensively advised about these matters before we would make a decision. We'd be, for example, an incoming defence minister would I'm sure provide a series of options available, and we'd also possibly consider other options that may not be contained within such a brief.
Much of the debate about submarines over the past decade has focused on getting building in Australia, as much as possible building in Australia. Do you think that's important, or have we moved beyond that?
Oh, it's important in any defence asset that you look to deploy, wherever possible, is built in part or wholly in Australia. If that can be done, that is really important, because it builds, not only does it, of course, as a very important incidental consequence, provide high-skilled, well-paid jobs in this country and create more skills and broaden our skill base and deepen it, but it also is a part of defence capability. I mean, and it is providing greater sovereignty over the decisions we make in the area of national security. So anything we can do to continue to broaden and deepen the skills in our defence industry, the better. So, for example, you could enter into a contract for a defence asset where most of it or part of it or a large part of it has to be built overseas initially, but you want to build into that contract the capacity for an increased proportion of that contract to be fulfilled in Australia, not just for the jobs and not just to improve our economy, but we are best placed to defend this nation if we have the skills to build and maintain defence assets ourselves. Now, that won't always be possible, but it's got to be part of the mix and it's got to be a priority. And a Labor government, if elected, where possible, would be putting in place in those huge contracts enforceable provisions in terms of local content. And the percentage of local content will vary dependent upon the capability of us delivering components of that contract. Despite so there'll be some areas, Michelle, where we could do 100%, and there'll be some areas where we'll be at a much lower level, but be seeking to grow as our skill base grows.
Despite the rhetoric, however, it does seem that the nuclear-powered subs would not be substantially built in Australia. Is that a reasonable
conclusion? Well, certainly what changed under the offer by the United States, United Kingdom to provide this technology to us? Well, what changed was the nuclear component of the submarine would last the life of the submarine. And that meant we didn't have to deal with that component. And of course, that component will be built elsewhere. But there is a huge proportion of submarines that could be built in Australia. Now, I'm on the record saying Shadow Defence Minister and possible Defence Minister if Labor's elected, I would say that my priority has to be to make sure we have the capability to defend this nation, and nothing is more important than that. But what we need to be looking to do in a world that's becoming more uncertain, where supply chains are being interrupted, where things are scarce, when you're looking to whether it's in the and I think that's been exposed under this pandemic, is that we need to think about standing on our own two feet in so far as delivering defence assets. And we can't be continuing to consider that the only option is buying off the shelf or buying off. And people may say that's rhetoric. It's not rhetoric. It has to be the goal of any government. And I'd say it has to be the goal of Labor or Liberal governments, because these contracts, as you know, Michelle, often go between 15, 20 or 30 years. And so it's really important there's a consensus around building our capability in terms of our local defence industry. But there'll be occasions in which we cannot immediately invest in the local build, and we will have to look overseas, because ultimately we have to make sure this country's defended properly.
Brendan O'Connor, thank you very much for talking with the Conversations Politics podcast today. And that's all for now. Thank you to my producer, Ellen Duffy. We'll be back with another interview soon, but goodbye for now.
Our theme music is by Lee Rosevere. You can find more podcasts from The Conversation on our website at theconversation.com.